Friday, March 5th, 2410. 8:30 a.m. Avalon Standard Time. Green Sector Diplomatic Quarters. To her considerable surprise, Utina slept pretty well that night. She woke feeling refreshed and, almost, ready for the day ahead, only to find herself, after a shower and a light breakfast, with an hour or so to kill. Lingering over her morning coffee, she pondered how to go about killing that hour, then smiled as she hit on the perfect thing to finish settling her nerves. With motions made smooth by long practice, she dug her SimSense deck out of her suitcase, unpacked it, set it up on the coffee table, and taped on the trodes. Then, settling back on the sofa, she reached out and thwacked the green button. The fizzing sensation of SimSense transition picked her up from the sofa and dropped her in a small white room with a control panel and an old-fashioned telephone on the wall. There was a thin, hawk-nosed man in a white coverall and cap standing by the panel, making some notes on a clipboard. He looked up as she arrived and smiled broadly.
"Ah, guten Tag, Captain," he said with a marked German accent. "What can I get for you today?"
Years before, when she'd set out to learn what she needed to know in order to earn a Starship Master's certificate, Corwin had taken Utina into a sensory simulation for the first time in order to illustrate a point. The simulation had been of the launch of Apollo 11, the first expedition by Earthmen to their planet's only moon, 30 years before first contact. Over the years since then, she'd made something of a hobby of collecting simulations of early space flights, and by 2408 she'd amassed a sizable number, enough that keeping track of them was starting to become a problem. Corwin had solved that problem by developing an expert shell program to help her manage them and presenting it to her on her birthday that year. He'd based that program's persona on Günter Wendt, the leader of NASA's launch pad crew back in the 1960s, the character version of whom was a fixture in many of the sims. Günter the program wasn't a true AI, but he was a pretty sophisticated interactive shell, and Utina had become inordinately fond of him. Now she smiled and said, "Good morning, Günter. Let's have, Apollo 8 today. I don't have time to do a landing." Günter nodded and made a couple of notes on his clipboard. "Excellent. I assume you'll be playing the role of Frank Borman, yeah? A marked improvement, if you don't mind my saying so. And that's no reflection on Frank. Let me just get it set up for you. Shall I leave Lovell and Anders or Scrubs him?"
9:30 a.m. The Garden. By 9:30, the guests were beginning to arrive. The ones arriving this early would have a fairly long wait. The ceremony wasn't scheduled to begin until 11:30. But there were a lot of people to get seated, and those who could had been specifically asked to stagger their arrivals in order to make the process go a little more smoothly. In the meantime, there were tables of appetizing snacks laid out in the meadow and cheerful uniformed ushers to direct people to their seats. Since the wedding was being conducted on an Asgardian basis, the seating arrangements deviated slightly from the standard sort of breakdown. Utina had no living blood relatives, and she was the adopted daughter of the groom's father, so instead of the usual family of the groom, family of the bride arrangement, Corwin's maternal relations and people who had known him before he met Utina were being placed on his side, while his paternal relations and Utina's proliferation of friends and colleagues gravitated toward the other. The two of them had practically no friends not in common anyway, so the whole thing had been at once simple to arrange and complicated to balance. The real difficulty, of course, was that there were so many of them. The lives of the two principals in today's little drama had intersected a tremendous number of others, and almost all of those whose lives they had touched were invited, from the core diplomatic and operational staff of Babylon 6 to members of no fewer than 4 space navies, independent operators,
private citizens, university professors, duelists and Jedi Knights, divinities and demons. And most of those who were invited were making the scene, dressed in formal wear or uniform, armor or ornate native garb. They numbered in their hundreds, and they were still arriving. Fortunately, the ushers, who are actually members of the Einherjar, the immortal army of Valhalla, permitted to visit Midgard this day thanks to a special dispensation from the Allfather, were well-drilled and on the ball, and as the place filled up, there seemed to be no difficulties. Duelists arriving from Sephiro, here. Corwin's childhood playmates from Asgard, Tomodachi, and New Avalon, there. Friends Utrina had made in the course of her adventures with the International Police Space Force, so. Everyone had a place, and nobody seemed to mind who they ended up near. With so long to go before the ceremony, most people mentally marked the location of their seats and then repaired to the snack area to mingle and chat, giving the whole thing something of the air of a reception at the wrong end of the day. Standing next to Corwin's Aunt Beldandy, the master organizer of all this, Lieutenant David Corwin took note of it and added, "Isn't it more customary to feed people after the ceremony?" Bell smiled. "Oh, we will, certainly. That's what that building over there is for. This is just to make sure no one falls over during the ceremony. Besides, if some of the guests are angling for hors d'oeuvres, it makes it easier for the boys to herd the rest into the right seating areas." Bruce, observing the ebb and flow of the meadow's increasing human tide, had to admit she had a point. "Well, things seem to be going smoothly so far," Bell said. "I must be off. I have an important part still to play." Chad Collier stood at the corner of the snack table, eyeing the assorted Asgardian fare and pondering how best to sneak another bacon-wrapped scallop onto his plate. He'd sent Spark out to take some candid shots of the reception guests, while Janice and X staked out a path to their seats in case there was a rush when the gong sounded, or however it was that they'd be notified it was time to sit down. Engrossed in logistics as he was, he didn't notice the approach of another guest until the other man spoke. "Chad Collier?" "One and the same," Chad said, turning to greet the newcomer. At first, Chad took him for some associate of Sumire Kanzaki's. Middle-aged, gray ponytail, mandarin collar on an expensive suit. The other man wouldn't have been out of place at any pitch meeting at the studio, sitting in the corner and asking hard questions about budgets and completion bonds. The left-handed handshake he offered Chad was unusual, though, as was the plain, unadorned metal cap that terminated the man's right arm. "I thought so," the older man said. "There aren't too many Kilrathi cult filmmakers out there these days." Chad returned the handshake and smiled. "Yeah, well, raised on Alderaan, human parents, what's a boy to do?" he replied with a self-deprecating shrug. The other man smiled a bit sardonically. "Affront to everything your species stands for, what?" he said dryly. "I guess a lot of native Kilrathi would think that," Chad replied. "I try not to hang out in those circles." The other man's smile broadened into a smirk. "I bet they'd just hate this, then," he said. And before Chad's eyes, he changed, growing taller, broader, heavily furred and scarred, still missing that hand, that paw, Chad corrected himself before realizing just who, precisely, he was looking at. The enormous white and black Imperial Kilrathi with the ice-blue eyes looked down on him, expressionless, silent. "You," Chad managed, every hair on the back of his neck standing erect. "Me indeed," Sivar replied. "We have much to speak of, Chad." "I don't know," Janice said, toying with her margarita a short distance away. "Everything's a little pear-shaped, I guess, and there's been a lot going on." X nodded. Nothing wrong with that, Red, he replied. None of us exactly have a nice, placid suburban life to fall back on, you know.
Better than anyone, she said with a wan smile. I don't know if I'd have it.
She cut her sentence short as a low rumble echoed through their end of the garden. X's head snapped up.
Chad, he said.
How do you...
No time, X said. Come on. They got up and made their way back over to the buffet table as decorously as possible, Mitra and Riddick in tow. About 30 feet away, they both saw it. Chad, fangs bared and hackles raised, facing off with an older man in a dark business suit. X motioned Janice to a stop.
You know that guy?
X said quietly. Janice shook her head.
Never seen him before in my life, she replied.
X remained still, expression wary, body tensed.
If Geek starts some shit here, he replied, you gonna cover me?
Janice nodded.
Good enough, X said. Beyond that, we're gonna wait right here.
Chad struggled to contain his emotions. You're responsible for all this, he said. All the years people have figured I'm some kind of fucking wild animal, some sort of goddamn religious fanatic. All the shit I went through proving to Karen's parents that I wasn't going to snap and sacrifice their daughter to you. Your fault. I have nothing to discuss with you, Sivar War God.
I would that we would speak with sheathed claws in the manner of the civilized, Sivar replied, unruffled.
The civilized? Chad replied derisively. Like your priestesses? Like those Kilrathi who go forth to rape and murder in your name?
I am still not speaking to them, Sivar replied. And I am still speaking to you, my son.
Chad froze, recalling a years ago adventure with Raoul Duke and Ezri Tegan on a long-lost ring world.
You son of a bitch! Where have you been?
I have turned my back upon those who called me their god, Sivar replied. The ringing finality in his voice made some part of Chad's hindbrain flinch. I do not expect to be received with reverence by those who have rejected me, and yet, among their numbers, I find my true children.
We've had this discussion, Chad said coldly.
I'm not convinced. Where the hell have you been all this time since Tatooine? Have your comrades in the International Police not moved against those who call themselves my archpriests? Sivar asked. Have you and your sworn brother Xander Cage not spoken valiantly in the defense of Shan Bastila against those who would have seen her expelled from the Jedi Order? Have you not lifted your own claws against the tyranny and fanaticism of the Covenant upon the Great Ring? Have I not been with you, Chad Collier? Have you not acted to stem the tide of darkness that threatens your friends, your family, your entire galaxy? Have I not looked upon your works and found them worthy of honor?
There is a lot of roaring going on over there, Janice observed calmly. Her hand was beginning to ache from its grip on her verista.
Indeed, 343 Guilty Spark replied. The little protocol drone had completed his photographic tasks for the time being, and come back to find his master in... Well, certainly it was trouble, just not any sort of trouble Spark would have recognized as such.
I didn't know Master Chad spoke Imperial Kilrathi, Spark added. His fluency is impressive.
X's eyebrows shot up his shaved head.
He doesn't.
Chad still stood frozen.
You were a voice in my head, he said softly. A drug trip. Duke whacked me up on mescaline, and my brain dreamed you up to scare the shit out of me.
Sivar shrugged. And yet I remember our conversation, such as it was, he replied. I remain convinced that I spoke the truth, as I speak the truth now.
I have not been with the Kilrathi, whose creation I oversaw, whose hearts are now closed to me, for many years, with very few exceptions. You've been the fanged sword hanging over my head every time I met a Kilrathi who wasn't Brit or the Bastard's Sons, Chad said. The model of Kilrathi warriorship, the epitome of everything I never wanted to be. Mighty Sivar. I hated myself every time I bought into a piece of that. And now I'm not sure what to think. I am still Sivar War God, the white Kilrathi replied. Of that you may have no doubt. But if I am somewhat less than you expected, you are more than I could have imagined. The powers of darkness have come to strike at the heart of your adopted kin, and you have set them back, time and again. Your loyalty, your love, although you do not speak of it easily, is the true way I had intended for my people. Chad looked down to the floor, suddenly overcome. Thank you, sir, he finally managed. I know your heart, Chad Collier, as do others among my company, Sivar said. We are a warrior race, a band of hunters, a people set apart. And I will have my final hunt, my revenge against those who have defiled my worship and dragged our people into a dark age. I will yet see them cast low. But you must promise me something. If I can do it, I will, Chad said. Avert your course from mine until I have conquered my prey, Sivar said, gripping Chad's shoulder tightly. Avert your eyes from my hunt until its final moments. Upon that day you will behold my wrath, and the punishment given to heretics, and I would subject my children to neither. Chad nodded numbly, almost unable to comprehend the words. I will, he said haltingly. I'll stay away. I don't know where you're going, but I'll stay away. Sivar nodded. That is all I may ask until my hunt is concluded. Shall we attend to other matters? With that, the Kilrathi war god assumed his Norse aspect once more, plucked a single scallop from the platter, and placed it on Chad's plate with a smile before moving off to another part of the garden. Janice sighed and relaxed her grip on the barista. I guess we're not supposed to know what that was all about, she remarked. X shrugged, then pivoted smoothly on the ball of one foot and put a hand down on a passing Valkyrie's shoulder. Or he would have, if she hadn't sensed the gesture coming, slipped aside, slapped his hand smartly away, and faced off with him in a martial arts ready stance, poised and ready. On the face of it, that confrontation should have seemed a little silly to an outside observer, like, say, Janice, in large part because the Valkyrie in question was no more than 3 feet tall, and proportioned accordingly, with tiny fists no bigger than billiard balls. Without a scale reference, she'd have looked like a perfectly normal, if rather petite, woman, but viewed against Cage's 6 feet of solid muscle, the disparity was stark and a bit ridiculous. At a glance, it looked like X was being challenged by a 4-year-old. A closer look, though, dispelled the illusion immediately. Aaron Stonefist, the Valkyrie close combat specialist, was hardly a 4-year-old. She was a native of Vanaheim's northern Shire, and the look in her cool blue eyes as she fixed them on X's was anything but childlike. Having made her point, Aaron relaxed slightly and said, Sorry, Cage, but you ought to watch where you throw those hands. You'll find that few Vaetir appreciate being manhandled by the big folk. X grinned and held up his hands in surrender. Sorry, he said. I'm just looking for a little information. Aaron relaxed fully, raking her thick black hair back from her forehead, and asked, What do you want to know? That guy over there in the suit, said X, gesturing with his head. Who is he? Aaron turned,
then blinked and regarded X with surprise.
You...
Well, no, I guess you couldn't be expected to know, she said, shaking her head. That, my dear sir, is Tyr Grimjaws, the leavings of the wolf Fenris, the Æsir's great champion, Asgard's god of war. She watched for a moment to see if he wanted anything else, then concluded from the rather blank look on his face that he didn't, and continued on her way.
Fuck, X said.
Janice just stood there, looking uneasy.
I'm entirely at a loss, she finally said. Someone should probably get Chad a drink, though.
When the door of her borrowed diplomat's quarters opened at 10:15, Utina had finished her simulation run and was sitting on the couch, not really watching the news. She looked up and smiled as her half of the wedding party entered, reflecting as she did that wedding party was really the wrong term for the group of people tasked with attending and assisting the bride and groom in this particular deal. Wedding Special Mission Force might be closer to the mark if you wanted to use the IPO Tactical Division term for such things. Oh, they didn't look all that formidable right now, but then they weren't arrayed for battle yet. An uninformed observer might take them for a simple clutch of college girls, but Utina knew much better. If it came to it, she'd be just as confident going into a fight with these four women at her back as she would with an entire army. Maybe more so.
Morning, Utina, said Caitlin Hutchins cheerfully. Are you ready?
Utina stood up, hugged her best friend, and said with equal cheer, I sincerely doubt it. But let's go. The five, Utina, Caitlin, Wakaba Shinohara, Vigdis, and R. Dorothy Wainwright, walked from the visiting diplomatic quarters to the back corner of the garden. They followed a route, mapped out for them by the station's executive officer, Susan Ivanova, through station service corridors to a special access way so that they wouldn't be seen by any of the people beginning to gather in the adjoining area where the ceremony was actually being held. They started out chattering among themselves as friends do, but as they drew closer to their destination, they became slowly quieter. By the time they emerged from the access passage, they were all but silent, filled with anticipation and wrapped in a kind of reverent hush. A sense of occasion had settled upon them all, the first true realization, with heart as well as head, of what they were all there to play a part in. The passageway gave onto a warm, fragrant room, paneled in cedar and dominated by a large circular tub of steaming water, on the surface of which, naturally, had been scattered handsful of white rose petals. Waiting for them there, smiling beatifically, was Beldandy. No, Utina corrected herself. In those elaborate blue and white robes, with her hair down and her gold and silver accoutrements shining, this was Vertandi Wishbringer, not just Corwin's lovable Aunt Belle Morisato, greeting them.
Welcome, she said.
Under anything resembling normal circumstances, Utina Tenjo would have felt at best rather silly, and at worst extremely weird, as five women, even these five, maybe especially these five, divested her ceremoniously of her everyday clothes, bathed her, and then dressed her in entirely unfamiliar garb. It was not the sort of thing she would customarily submit herself to say the least. Somehow, though, maybe because of her conversation with Vigdis the day before, maybe because of Vertandi's soothing presence, maybe some of both, it all felt right. It was a most uncommon experience, but then this was a most uncommon day. Cleansed and clad in her brand new finery, she sat César on an immaculate woven mat, while Vertandi slowly, methodically, but sparingly applied makeup, another thing she almost never bothered with, to her face. Once that job was done, and with even greater ceremony than had gone before, the Norn of today unwrapped a black velvet parcel and fitted the item it had protected carefully upon Utina's head. Then she raised her charge to her feet and said, "Your preparations are complete. Are you ready?"
Utna smiled and answered truthfully, "No."
Then she added wryly, "Ironically, I've spent my entire life quite deliberately being not ready for this moment."
Vertandi chuckled indulgently. "I thought as much. Well then, this should fit in with all the other defining moments of your life in one respect. The hour has come whether you're ready or not."
"She's right, you know," said Wakaba. "Don't have a clue what you're doing, grit your teeth and bull through anyway, end up looking like you had a plan from the start."
Caitlin nodded agreement. "It's very you."
Utna rolled her eyes. "Thank you, ladies." Then, turning back to Vertandi with a faintly troubled expression, she said, "I know what to do, I just don't know if I'm the right person to be doing it."
Vertandi took her hands, gave her one of the most loving smiles she'd ever received, and said,
"You know, a few years ago, I helped with the wedding of another young woman who, at the 11th hour, wondered that same thing. I'll tell you the same thing I told her. I know the truth of a lover's heart. If I didn't think this was right, I wouldn't be helping."
Utna considered the Norn's words gravely for a few seconds, then grinned, looking much more her usual self.
"That was just what I needed to hear," she said.
Vertandi beamed.
"It's a gift," she said modestly.
Utna laughed.
"Let's do this thing."
At about the same time Caitlin and her detachment reached the diplomatic quarters, another group of wedding commandos arrived at another stateroom on another level of the station to find an entirely different set of circumstances waiting for them. Nall Silverclaw, in his human form, Thor Ironhammer, Lenneth Winternight, and Gudrun Trumace didn't actually reach Corwin's assigned room in the VOQ. Instead, their attention caught by the raucous rock music blaring from the open door of the next room over, they glanced inside and spotted him in there. Far from being tense and impatient, as Nall had expected, Corwin seemed completely happy, down on one knee, wrench in hand, bolting down the front panel of a small, cube-shaped robot, while another, much more sophisticated, repulsor-lifted model watched over his shoulder and bobbed gently with the beat. He was so relaxed, in fact, that he was even singing along with the blasting music.
"You can ponder perpetual motion, fix your mind on a crystal day. Always time for a good conversation. There's an ear for what you say."
"Corwin?" Nall blurted, staring at the scene without fully comprehending it. Corwin looked up.
"Oh, hey, Nall!"
he yelled over the guitar solo. Then, reaching to the small robot's front panel, he turned down the music a little.
"Is it that time already? I'm just finishing up here."
So saying, he closed up the cube-shaped robot's front panel, gave the speaker set into that panel a quick going-over with some canned air, then gave the robot a friendly thump.
"There. How's that?"
The robot's fork-like, three-fingered manipulators weren't well-suited to giving the thumbs up, but he tried anyway.
"Good deal," said Corwin.
Straightening up, he brushed at his knees and added, "Good as new and just in time." With a gleeful expression, he shared a high five first with the square robot, then with the hovering white one.
What the hell are you doing?"
Nall sputtered.
"Making new friends," said Corwin with a smile. "Guys, this is my buddy Nall. He's going to be best man at my wedding today."
"Eve," said the white robot, bobbing in the air in a sort of anti-gravity curtsy.
The older robot rolled over on well-polished tracks and extended a scrupulously clean manipulator.
Wally,
he burbled, shaking Nall's rather slack hand.
Hi, said Nall distractedly. Nice to meet you. Would you excuse me for a second?
Then, edging past them to advance on Corwin as he washed his hands at the kitchenette sink, he hissed,
You are supposed to be ready.
Corwin shrugged. Yeah, ready to get ready. He finished washing his hands, dried them on a dish towel, then presented himself, hands open at his sides, and added, Which I am. Nall stood and stared at him, hands working ineffectually at his sides. Corwin looked, well, about as Nall would expect him to look after pulling an all-nighter overhauling some ancient robot, rumpled, grease-stained, and generally besmirched. The mere mortal hand soap provided in the VOQ kitchenette hadn't even dented the grunge under his fingernails.
You idiot! Nall burst out. The bath is just part of the procedure. It's supposed to be symbolic. There's no provision for you actually being all greasy and shit.
Lenneth laughed and clapped the distraught dragon on the shoulder. Relax, Nall. You don't think we have a protocol for this kind of thing in place by now? That's why I was chosen to be one of his attendants. If I could make him presentable for the Vanaheim Hunt Ball half an hour after we finished overhauling a jet engine, and I did, I can handle this. Corwin surveyed the chaos of tools, parts, and scrap materials scattered around the floor and tables in the stateroom, then sighed and said, Guess we'll have to clean this up later. Come on, you guys. Nall blinked. You're bringing the robots along? He asked, sotto voce. Sure, Corwin replied, unconcerned. Didn't I just say they're my friends? The group, now seven strong, took a circuitous path designed to keep them away from the meadow and also negate any possible chance of their running into the other team. Presently they emerged from another, similar access tunnel into another, similar, cedar-paneled room, though in this one Vertandi was not waiting, since even she could not be in two places at once. The proceedings that followed weren't as ceremonious at first as their counterparts in the other bathhouse. For instance, the groom wasn't expected to just sit there and let his attendants do the washing. That would just have been weird. What ensued instead was more like a regular trip to the Valhalla Banya after a hard day's Valkyrieing. And since he'd grown up having such days all his life, Corwin didn't find anything awkward in the fact that two of his attendants were women. I wonder if it's a bad omen if we can't actually get heat sink paste out of his hair, Gudrun wondered. How did you get it in your hair? Nall demanded. Obviously, you've never overhauled a robot, said Lenneth. Hold still, Corwin. Ow, that's attached, you know. Laugh it up, God boy. If we can't get this out, we'll have to shave it, and you'll be married with the Nine World's worst comb-over. Thus it went, at least until the cleaning was done, thermal paste removed successfully, and the time came to get dressed. That was a much more involved and elaborate process than usual, as the two Valkyrie assembled upon their comrade a set of raiments much more complex than even the ornate dress uniforms they themselves had donned. At the very end, Eve got in on the act as well, using her hover capability to help him on with his coat so that Lenneth could fasten it. Perfect, Lenneth remarked.
Very nice, Nall agreed.
Ooh,
Wally and Eve concurred.
Outstanding, said Thor. I haven't seen its like since, well, since Baldur's return from hell, I think.
Corwin laughed. You're one for the photo album yourself, Uncle, he said. I can count the times I've seen you in something other than jeans and a t-shirt on one hand.
Aye, Thor replied, grunting as he wrestled his way into his ceremonial armor's breastplate. And now I can't quite remember how this all goes together.
Here, let me help,
Gudrun tutted. Hold still.
While the Thunder God and the Valkyrie struggled with that, the side door opened and the tall, grizzled figure of Odin Winterbeard, even more imposing than usual in his finest of Aesir finery, entered. The Allfather's face brightened at the sight of his grandson fully bedecked, and he turned a blind eye, figuratively speaking, to Thor's battle with his armor as he spoke.
"You look well, Corwin," he said.
Corwin half bowed.
"Thank you, Grandfather."
Stepping closer, Odin smiled and put his hand on Corwin's shoulder.
"Are you ready?" he asked.
Corwin grinned.
"Nope,"
he replied happily. While all that was going on, Mitsuru Tsuwabuki stood in a small knot of duelists from the Sephiro and Gerardo chapters at the edge of the meadow, chatting with his DSM counterpart, Boba Fett, and generally feeling good about the occasion. The last of the guests, the contingent from Asgard, including the Aesir Council themselves, were arriving now. The snacking and seating were going smoothly. T-minus... he checked his watch. 27 minutes and counting, and everything still looked good. By his side, the Tenjo Academy Order of the Roses recently arrived guest, Anaximandra Drax, stood shaded under a parasol and took in the scene with wide blue eyes that contrasted starkly with her ink-black skin. Though not actually a duelist, the Svartelvan refugee was recently enough arrived that Tsuwabuki had been reluctant to leave her behind at the academy while he and his colleagues attended the wedding. And the word from both Utna and Corwin when asked was, "Sure, bring her along." So he had.
"This is amazing," she murmured. "So many people from so many different worlds."
Pointing across the meadow, she added,
"Look, even Svartalfheim has sent an ambassador."
Tsuwabuki blinked.
"What?
No, the Svartalfheim government specifically declined their inv—" His voice trailed off as his eyes followed Anaximandra's pointing finger, and saw the individual she was pointing to. A dark-skinned, thin-faced man in red-trimmed black, adorned with a diplomatic sash and medals. He had silver hair swept back in a ponytail, and on his arm was a tall blonde woman in silver and white Asgardian robes. The pair of them stood just outside the door leading onto the meadow from the building that was really the main access point to Blue Sector, surveying the scene. For a moment, Mitsuru Tsuwabuki's mind simply could not grasp what he was looking at. Once it did, it took him a few further seconds to find his momentarily misplaced ability to speak, and when he did, what came out in a low, dread-filled murmur was,
"Shit."
Boba Fett, who had missed the byplay with Anaximandra, turned and arched an eyebrow at Tsuwabuki.
"What?"
"Over there," said Tsuwabuki, gesturing with his chin. Fett looked, blinked, and said in a disbelieving tone,
"Now."
Tsuwabuki nodded glumly.
"Yup."
"Shit,"
Boba growled. Then, instantly businesslike, he raised his hand and tabbed the comlink on the back of it to life. "Fett to Shin-Guji," he snapped.
"Go ahead, Boba,"
a slightly puzzled young woman's voice replied.
"Mimi, we have a problem. Akio Otori is here."
A silent beat, then,
"Say again?"
At almost the same moment, Master Chief Petty Officer Sir John Spartan, RSN, KDSC, etc., was scanning the other side of the crowd with gimlet eyes. He wasn't honestly expecting trouble, but old habits die hard, and in a big open space like this, his instincts told him to be wary. Not of any specific thing, but wary, all the same. An instant later, Cortana's voice spoke directly into his aural nerves, as well as Janice's, X's, and Chad's.
John, who knew Cortana as well as, if not better than, he knew himself, recognized her tone of voice instantly as the one that usually heralded some kind of crisis. "Heads up, Team Spartan," she said. "I just got the final rev of the guest list, and there's probably going to be trouble." Across the meadow, Boba Fett had pulled up a copy of the same list on a wrist-mounted holo display and was scowling at it. "It looks like he was invited by Lady Freya of Vanaheim," he said, both to the duelists gathered around him and to Mimi Shinguchi via his still-open comm link. "Oh, for... what do we do?" Mimi asked. "I need you to notify your mother and the others from Ishiyama," Boba told her. Tsuwabuki turned to two of his duelists. "Card, you're on the rest of our group. Keiko, you take Bathhouse G. Juniper, Bathhouse B. Lindsay, I need you to warn the new Avalon contingent," Boba continued. "Sakura, inform Lieutenant Corwin. I'll see if I can get to the chief. And let's get this done as quietly as we can, people. He wants to start a panic. Let's not oblige him." Bruce Corwin ran full tilt down the long corridor linking Turboshaft A to the station commander's conference room, which happened to be in the top floor of that same false building leading from Blue Sector into the garden, burst through the door, and breathlessly announced, "There's a problem." At the conference table, Ivanova, Captain Derek Bacon, and Security Chief Michael Garibaldi turned to face him with looks of mild surprise, though it became quickly clear that it was surprise at his entrance, not at his message. "We know," Ivanova said. "Sit down." Down on the meadow, Akio Otori was thoroughly enjoying himself. As he and Freya made their entrance, he could sense the frisson racing through the gathering. And if it wasn't quite the open commotion he'd been rather hoping for, it was still satisfying. A lot of these people had no idea who he was or what importance his presence held, of course, but the ones who counted did, and they knew he was here. By now, presumably, word was being run to the happy couple, wherever they were lurking while they made their final preparations. He wondered if they would still go through with it. If they didn't, of course, that would be a significant victory, though the sweetest outcome of all would be the outbreak of a fight. He ached for one of Tenjo's hot-headed young disciples. The children, he was sure, had heard of him, but who had no real conception of what he truly was, to confront him, challenge him, try to drive him away. "Freya, darling, why don't you go ahead and mingle with the others from Asgard?" he said calmly to his date. "I'm going to stay here for a little while and just take it all in." Freya nodded, smiling, and moved off toward the corner of the crowd where most of her peers had gathered. Akio, gleefully conscious of the eyes following him, made his way to one of the tables and had just selected a glass of mineral water when he became aware of one set of eyes watching him a bit more intently than all the others. Akio Otori had had many strange experiences in his life, but he couldn't recall ever having been faced down by a small dog before. But here was one now, a hound of some description, tan and white, staring up at him with naked hostility in its brown eyes. The dog wasn't actually snarling, but it was emitting a low, sustained growl that packed surprising menace coming from so small an animal. He was just considering whether to give it a discouraging kick when it was joined by another, this one of similar build but leaner, sporting some black in its coloration and wearing dark goggles. This one didn't even growl. It just stared, giving him the eerie impression that, inside its goggles, its eyes were faintly glowing. "They don't like you," explained a burly, bald-headed young man dressed in an IPO commando sweater, neatly pressed fatigue pants, and spit-shined tanker boots. Akio blinked slowly, regarded the two dogs, looked at the man who'd addressed him, and then said dryly, "I'm sorry."
Xander Cage picked up a glass of water from the table, tossed it back in one gulp, and put it back down. Then he regarded Akio with a look almost as intense as the two dogs, and added, in what was probably as casual a tone as his deep, rock-cutting voice could manage,
"I don't like you either."
Akio didn't quite know what to make of that, and said nothing.
"You better watch yourself," X went on. "Riddick has the death sentence in 12 systems."
The tricolored dog's lip curled back from one gleaming white canine tooth, but he still didn't growl.
"I'll be careful," Akio replied patronizingly. "You'll be dead," X thought, but all he said aloud was, "Yeah, I bet you will."
Then, turning his back dismissively, he said, "Come on, boys. He ain't worth it." The two dogs continued staring Akio down for a few moments longer, then turned and trotted after X. Akio looked after them for a moment, deeply bemused. Then he turned to head the other way, and pulled up sharply as he nearly collided with an even weirder figure. He couldn't even tell just what this one was. It was just a tall shape, draped so heavily in rich patterned fabric that he couldn't even tell whether it was humanoid, with heavily armored shoulders, and a turret-like head sporting one softly glowing, mechanical-looking green eye on the front. Vorlon Ambassador Kosh Naranek gazed silently at the fallen prince for a few moments, then spoke. As always, his real voice was a collection of strange musical tones and muted sounds, incomprehensible to any human or human-like ear. Underneath those sounds, hushed standard words issued from a glowing panel on his chest.
"You do not belong here," said Kosh.
Akio blinked, then summoned his haughtiest look and replied, "I happen to be an invited guest." Kosh shook his head just once, imparting to the gesture an utter finality.
"Not in this place, in this world," he said.
He moved slowly closer, appearing to glide over the ground, and the baleful blank glow of his one green eye seemed to look right through Akio.
"Aberrant, corrupt, soulless," Kosh declared.
Then he moved closer still, until he was almost touching Akio. The iris of his eye widened to its fullest extent as he inclined his head to look the fallen full in the face and intoned,
"We are watching."
Then, seeming to dismiss Akio entirely from his awareness, the Vorlon ambassador backed away slightly, pivoted, and glided away, vanishing into the crowd. Akio frowned. Perhaps this wasn't going entirely to plan. As he walked away from the table, X keyed his bionic TACCOM. "Target identification complete. Red, you in position?"
"Roger that," Janice replied subvocally. From up on the top of one of the mock buildings at the meadow's edge, a few hundred yards from the snack tables, she adjusted the holoscope on her justy one click, double-checked her triangulation from Mitra, and nodded with satisfaction to herself.
"If that son of a bitch so much as twitches," she reported to the rest of her team, "I'm gonna blow him straight to Derna." "Hmm," mused Chip Moy to himself as Lindsay hurriedly explained the situation. "This is going to complicate my selection of sight lines unless I want to spend most of next month holo-shopping him out of frame. But hey, nobody said being the wedding photographer to the gods was going to be easy." If the duelists and their friends were doing their best to maintain an even strain, Frey Lightwalker was livid.
"I cannot believe you would do such a thing. he said to his sister in a furious whisper. The two stood off to the side while the rest of the Asgardian contingent tried, with varying degrees of success, to give the impression that they weren't paying any attention. Freya looked faintly bored. "Whom I choose to invite as my guest is none of your concern, Frey," she said. "Lord Trigon is a diplomatic envoy from the Court of Flame and the New Realm of Orifice. You've supported détente with Muspelheim before. Why the sudden change of heart?"
"Lord Trigon is a fraud, and you know it," Frey hissed. "This is a deliberate provocation. It is an affront to the dignity of Vanaheim itself, and it is beneath you."
Freya gave her twin a cold glare. "You weren't so concerned about affronts to the dignity of Vanaheim when you let the boy get away with mortally insulting me, my brother. This is the least he has earned." Frey managed to simultaneously sigh and seethe.
"You bring shame upon all the Aesir and Vanir. The Allfather will not forgive you."
Then, his voice nearly inaudible with fury, he added,
"Nor will I,"
before turning on his heel and stalking away. In Bathhouse B, Anne Cross's full-speed arrival and breathless message changed the atmosphere instantly from one of happily reverent preparation to something more akin to a council of war. Utina's first instinct was to throw open the door, charge across the meadow, and just throw down, motherfucker, get it over with. Only the earnest entreaties of Belle, Kate, and her loyal bridesmaids, and the fact that, since R. Dorothy Wainwright was one of them, no one was getting out that door if she didn't think it was a good idea, dissuaded her long enough for the first hot surge of temper to ebb. When it did, and a certain clarity of thought returned, then she was, barely, in a mood to listen to Wakaba's analysis of the situation. "He has to know that if he tries anything here and now, he'll be buying way more trouble than even he can pay off," Wakaba pointed out. "Besides all the duelists and special agents and space pirates and warrior princesses and all the other badass friends you've managed to make over the years, this place is full of gods and warriors of Valhalla. He's not stupid." Utina considered that, then gave her old friend a surprised look. "You know, you're right. So, he came all this way just to piss us off?" Wakaba nodded. "Sure looks like it to me." "Huh." Utina thought that over some more, then smirked faintly. "When you put it that way, I feel weirdly honored." Sobering, she added, "I wonder how Corwin's taking it." In Bathhouse G, it had to be admitted that Corwin wasn't taking it particularly well.
"Son of a bitch!"
he snarled, smacking the nearest non-fixed object, a bottle of shampoo, off the railing next to the tub and sending it ricocheting into the corner of the room. Nearby, Wally collapsed into storage mode in surprise at the sudden outburst, then peeked warily out.
"How did this happen?"
Corwin demanded, rounding on Keiko Sonoda.
"Hey, don't shoot the messenger, boss," Keiko replied. "I didn't invite him."
Corwin glared at her a moment longer, then subsided, looking slightly ashamed of himself.
"I know," he said. "I'm sorry, Keiko. It's just..."
Keiko nodded gravely.
"Yeah, I know. It's okay."
She hesitated, then went on.
It looks like he came with one of the guests from Asgard."
Corwin stared, incredulous.
"What? Who among the gods would do a thing like..."
His voice trailed off as the answer to his unfinished question dawned on him.
"Freya," he said, his face darkening.
At that very moment, as if summoned by his sister's name,
Frey burst through the side door into the bathhouse.
"Corwin," he said, "I apologize for the intrusion, but I must speak..."
"Oh. It seems you know."
Corwin gazed levelly at the Vanir prince for a few long moments, then said in a carefully restrained voice, "I'll give you this, Frey. You've got balls walking in here right now." By his side, almost unnoticed, Odin slowly, slowly slid a restraining hand onto his wrathful grandson's shoulder.
"I swear to you," said Frey, "I had no idea of my sister's intentions. If I had, I would have done everything in my power to stop her."
Corwin narrowed his eyes. "You've helped her make my life hell before."
Frey shook his head. "Not this time. What she's done today, it's obscene."
He clenched his fists and hung his head, clearly filled with shame.
"Corwin, it's true, I've abetted Freya's wrongs against you before. I'll confess these things even before the Allfather, right here and now, but this is too much."
His formal facade cracking under the weight of his frustration, he looked up, met Corwin's eyes, and blurted,
"I've had my fill of Freya's crazy shit. This madness must end."
He looked down at the floor again.
"For now, I truly fear that's what it is."
Corwin kept glaring at him for a moment longer. Then he slowly let the tension drain from his body, stepped from under Odin's hand, and sat down heavily on a bench.
"Okay, Frey. Okay," he said.
Pressing the heels of his hands to his eyes, he sat still for a long moment, then dropped his hands into his lap and gave a massive sigh.
"Damn it."
Wally finished retrieving the shampoo bottle and putting it back where it belonged, then rolled up alongside the bench, positioning himself solicitously nearby. A moment later, Eve joined him, hovering into place next to Corwin.
"What's going on?"
the sleek white droid coded.
"It's a long story, even for burst code," Corwin replied. "But basically, an old enemy of mine and Utinus, a man who's tried to kill us both more than once, in fact, managed to get himself invited by one of my relatives. He's outside now. He came to ruin the wedding."
Eve scowled. With a sharp clack, her right arm transformed from a slender, wing-like structure with a manipulator at the end into a full-length, large-bore cannon, complete with coaxial targeting laser.
"Directive?" she asked, her voice harsh.
"No, no, no," Corwin said hastily, putting a hand on top of the gun barrel and pushing it down.
"Tempting though it is, no."
He shook his head.
"You'd ruin your chances with the Turing board, or worse. The last thing you need right now is to be labeled a rogue robot."
Eve seemed unconvinced for a couple of seconds, then stood down, stowing the weapon.
"Understood," she said reluctantly.
Corwin looked up at Odin, who stood with arms folded, giving Frey a look that was not calculated to be particularly reassuring.
"Grandfather," he said, "I know it goes against tradition, but I have to talk to Utrina about this. There's no other way to handle this."
With a wry smile, he added, "And at this point, I just don't see how the whole good luck, bad luck thing is relevant."
Odin scowled but nodded.
"Agreed," he said. "What happens next cannot be your decision alone, nor hers."
Anthy Tenjo had been trying to stay out of the scrum all day. Both Utrina and Corwin had offered her a prominent, indeed a starring, role in the proceedings more than once, but she had politely declined every time,
insisting that this was to be their day, not hers, and that she wished merely to observe from the sidelines like all their other friends. This attitude had taken both of them aback at first, and there had followed many long and probing question-and-answer sessions in which first Utna, then Corwin, and then both of them together had worked to make absolutely certain that Anthy wasn't slipping into her old habit of being fanatically, in some cases destructively, selfless. The whole thing had amused and touched Anthy at the same time that, if she were being quite honest, it annoyed her. After all this time, a person would think her beloved still didn't trust her to know her own mind. She hadn't participated in the planning or the execution of any part of the ceremony or its attendant trappings. She wasn't wearing a fancy dress, which she would have been ill-suited to wear at this point in any case. She didn't have to follow any stage directions. She was just going to sit in a chair with friends all around her and watch as the two people she loved most took the final symbolic step to cement the bond that, in many ways, had saved her own life. Anthy wasn't entirely sure, even after all that had gone before, that she'd ever really been able to make either Corwin or Utna understand that point exactly. That she believed without reservation that the love which had grown between the two of them during Utna's exile in Midgard was directly responsible for Anthy's continued existence, to say nothing of the near-perfect life she felt she was now blessed to live. On some level, some deep-rooted cultural programming still compelled both of them to feel surprised that she didn't find it threatening. She'd decided long ago that she would probably never be able to explain it in words, and determined that, instead, she would simply demonstrate it with her actions. And so she was here, sitting among the duelists who had come from Tomodachi and New Avalon, that first generation, many of them Sephirian veterans of the Grand Tournament itself, who best understood the long and rocky road Anthy Himemia, the Rose Bride, had walked on her way to becoming Anthy Tenjo, High Priestess of the Pillar of Sephiro. She would be part of the ceremony without taking part in it, and as she waited for it to begin, she felt perfectly, blissfully happy. Until Lindsay Willows ran breathlessly up to the group and informed them of Suwabuki's discovery. Once, Anthy might have felt fear at the knowledge that her tormentor of so many years, the revenant thing that wore her beloved dead brother's face, had come to this place. That was a long time ago. Today she felt only... what was this feeling called? Oh yes, rage. Sitting next to her, Mikikoru saw the muscles at the corner of her jaw jump and gently covered her hand with his. "It'll be all right," he said calmly. "Don't you see? This is a hollow gesture. Toothless, pathetic. He can't act. Not under these conditions. He thinks that simply by showing himself he can spoil the day." He shook his head with a sad smile. "You know, in a way I pity him." "Hmm," Juri Arisugawa agreed from her seat on the far side of Miki's. "And to think he held such terrible sway over all of us once. What's he reduced to now? Petty tricks and nonsense." "All he's accomplished with this stunt," Miki declared, "is to add fuel to a fire that will one day destroy him." Anthy sighed. "I suppose you're right," she said. Juri read her expression, reached across Miki's lap, and added her hand to his. "You want to confront him," she said. "Don't. You shouldn't even show him your face." Miki nodded. "I concur," he said. "He doesn't deserve to see you, much less speak to you." Tom Palmer walked up, caught the last bit, and Catcher crouched in front of Anthy, taking her free hand in both of his own. "If he tries to engage any of us in conversation," he said flatly, "we ignore him. Mitsuru suggested it, and we all agreed it was the best way, to just pretend he isn't even here." With a slight smirk, he added, "For an attention whore like him, that should be worse than a punch in the face."
Anthy couldn't help it. She smiled slightly, if a little wanly.
"Language, Mr. Palmer," she mock-chided him.
At the front of the seating section on Corwin's side, others were finding it difficult to muster any kind of smile at all.
"Are you all right?"
Griffin asked the petite, dark-clad figure of his apprentice.
"No,"
Raven replied in a voice like scraped glass. She could, Griffin knew, be excused for feeling that way. After all, Akio Otori was her very own father, and not 3 months before he'd tried to deceive her, seduce her, murder her, and steal her soul, and very nearly succeeded in all four things.
"Let me rephrase the question," he said, taking her hand. "Will you be all right?"
Raven turned her head and looked up at him, her violet eyes huge and dark. And when she replied, her quiet voice had a faint eldritch edge in it.
"Every fiber of my body, every instinct in my heart, every quantum of my soul is screaming for his blood," she said.
Griffin nodded slowly.
"I know," he said. "But will you be all right?"
She looked down for a long moment, her hand tightening on his. Then she looked back, tears unshed, and said,
"I will."
And then, in an even quieter, nearly inaudible voice,
"I have to be."
Griffin put an arm around her shoulders and drew her tightly to him.
"Brave heart," he murmured. And somehow when he said that kind of thing to her, it didn't seem patronizing.
While he did his best to comfort Raven, the voice of Derek Bacon suddenly touched Griffin's mind.
"Griff, we've got a problem."
"Tell me about it," he replied wryly.
"No, I mean besides that. There's a major situation developing off station. I convinced Lou not to bother you with it at first, but it's getting worse. A lot worse."
"Tell me." Derek told him.
"Damn.
Okay. Here's what I need you to do. Get Lou in the loop with you and make it happen. Quick and quiet."